journey over, all is mended, and it's not just for today, but tomorrow, and extended, ever after.
Ever after!
All the curses have been ended, the reverses wiped away, all is tenderness and laughter, for forever after.
Happy now and happy hence and happy ever after!
There were dangers and confusions, and the paths would often swerve. There were constant disillusions, but they never lost their nerve,
and they reached the right conclusions.
And we got what we deserve.
No desire, no sorrow, tenderness and laughter.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, February 26, 2012. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a writer. You can see his writing at the New York Star Ledger. He writes for Masterworks Broadway on Tuesday, for Critcher Land on Friday, and also for the MTI blog throughout the month. Good morning, Peter.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a writer and photographer. You can see his writing and photography at BroadwayStars.com. You could also see his other writings at Arts America, NPR. You can see him also for the Sondheim Review. He writes sometimes. And also his photography at FollowSpotPhoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
So we have a show called CQCX that... we'll get into the title of it in a little while, but Michael and Peter have seen it. So, Peter, why don't you start us off with CQCX?
CQCX. Journalists use these terms. CQ is when you mean exactly what you say, exactly how you spelled it. If there's a funky name, often we put in CQ to indicate, no, that is the way it's spelled. Do not fool around with the spelling whatsoever, even if it looks strange, you know, because we have a lot of people today who have names who are spelled atypically, and it's easy for an editor to assume that the journalist made a mistake in spelling the name. Nope, CQ means this is what it is. CX means no, this has to be corrected. This is about the Jason Blair scandal of a few years ago, when Jason Blair, the journalist for the New York Times, simply plagiarized and got caught. It's very hard to get away with this type of thing in the internet age. The play is certainly watchable and is reasonably entertaining while you're sitting there, but it doesn't really delve into why this guy did this, and that's pretty surprising to me. He is a young person who feels he has the world by the tail. Here he is. He really expects that he is going to make a name for himself at the time. He really feels destined to be this important journalist. And when that doesn't quite happen, when people start noticing, when one editor especially starts noticing that he's making mistakes, it's sort of a meltdown that he has, but we don't even see that either. Mm. What's surprising to me, very surprising, is that editor who catches him early on is never brought into the action when we discover that he has been plagiarizing. You would think that he would show up and be telling editors, I told you so. Didn't I tell you to watch out for this guy? And that never happens, which is very surprising to me. The people who are on his side originally are the ones who have to say, oh, wow, this guy isn't what we thought he was. But why isn't the person who suspected him all along of being sloppy in his stories brought back into the action? So nice production at the Atlantic Theater Company, even as though it's at the old Signature Theater space way out west on 42nd Street. It moves well, beautifully produced. Notice when you go what's actually in the wings. There's some set design there that's interesting and expensive, and they spent a lot of money to have a very small effect, but it's there. The acting's fine. I have no problem with any of that, but there's still unanswered questions about why this happened. It's almost as if Gabe McKinley, the playwright, was doing an outline for a play more than a play itself. So while it's certainly sit-throughable and occasionally intriguing, you don't feel like you get all the answers. So I don't know if we're going to see more of this play as time goes on. I think this may be the last we see of it.
Michael, how did you think?
I would agree with everything Peter said. I thought it was disappointing overall in that it could have been so much better. I thought the scenes involving the editor of whom Peter spoke, here he's called Ben, simply Ben. I don't know what the real person's name was. And he's played by Tim Hopper in a terrific performance. Those scenes really crackled where he's Ben is sort of catching on and going to Jay and saying, what's going on with this? You know, this is, you know, and really calling him on the carpet. And he basically washes his hands of him eventually. And then he goes on to, you know, but the other people keep him. I thought those scenes really crackled and they were absolutely fantastic. And a lot of the other scenes involving the actual mechanics of what happened. But then I felt there was quite a lot of extraneous material with Jay's relationship with some of his other colleagues. And I realized that they did it to try to, you know, flesh him out and not have it be only about his plagiarism. But I just didn't think those scenes were as compelling. It was an unbelievably fascinating story. You could not make it up. And on top of, Peter didn't mention, but a major point here is that, Jason Blair is black. And that was very much a part of the whole situation, in terms of, it being felt by many people that he would not have been given so many chances and been given a pass, and he would have been scrutinized much more closely and would have been out on his butt years earlier if that had not been the case. And in fact, Blair himself wrote in 2004, a book about the whole situation called Burning Down My Master's House, My Life at the New York Times. So he certainly, you know, himself very much acknowledges that racism was part of what happened, a big part of what happened. I didn't read the book. I certainly didn't want to give him any of my money. I suppose I could get a copy if, you know, if I wanted to somewhere. I don't know in the book how much he says about why he did what he did and how he ever thought that he could get away with it. Maybe I will try to get a copy of it, the book, because, he did things like, aside from plagiarism, he did things like pretending he was, you know, off somewhere in, say, New Orleans, I think maybe actually was one of the places writing. And he covered the horrible sniper situation in the Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. area years ago. He covered that. And on many occasions, he pretended he wasn't even in the city. He was, I guess, at home in New York and pretending to file stories from Washington, D.C. So it was just an incredible situation. And the Times was unbelievably embarrassed by it. And they when the whole thing finally fell apart, they published a tremendously long article in the Times itself, basically calling themselves irresponsible, sort of a preemptive strike, I guess, in a way, you know, that article deserves to be read. It's incredible how they point by point show how the mistakes that were made and how they never should have happened and how irresponsible everyone was. And it was a low point in the in the life of the paper. So, yes, as Peter said, a very honorable piece of work, CQCX, by Gabe McKinley, directed by David Laveau, by the way, which is interesting because he has been a Broadway director for quite a few years, and this is an off-Broadway production. And Larry Brigman is terrific in it. Also, we have Peter J. Fernandez, Tim Hopper, whom I mentioned, Arliss Howard, Kobe Libby, David Pitu, who I always love watching on stage, Steve Rosen and Sheila Tapia. So it's, you know, it's worth seeing, but I just felt that it could have been something better. Also, it seems to me that I wonder if it's if it was or is intended maybe to be a film at some point.
I'm glad you mentioned Larry Brigman, by the way, an actor I first saw in 1965 do Edward Albee's Tiny Alice at the Theater Company of Boston, a long-gone theater company.
Wow.
But it doesn't look to me as if it's possible that this man has been acting for so long. He still has vitality. He has great energy. He doesn't look particularly old. I've been at parties where he's been. He doesn't look particularly old. He's really amazing, and I'm delighted to see him working and working so well. So I'm glad you mentioned him.
Yes.
You know, it's... we're going to talk a little bit about the title CQCX, and Peter mentioned its origins and where it came from. I just can't believe that this title made it through the stages.
I agree. Yeah,
it just doesn't serve the piece at all. It doesn't serve the audience. It's not audience friendly at all.
No,
it's clever not. And it's inside baseball, and it's
sure.
I don't know what they were thinking for this, although the production at the Atlantic Theater Company has extended, and they seem to have got a nice little cachet of people who are interested in seeing this. But I'm not sure, you know, outside the ranks of, you know, 8th Avenue in the New York Times building, and after you run through all those people who are going to run down and see this, I don't know who else is going to go see this, but...
Maybe they should have called it Burning Down My Master's House, My Life at the New York Times, and given him a taste of his own medicine.
Right, that's right, that's right. Yeah. And see if he'd sue, if he dared to sue, you know.
Peter, did you learn those? I mean, because those are really like editors' marks, CQCX. Did you learn them somewhere?
I use CQ quite a bit.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Quite a bit. I mean, as I say, because there are so many people who have their names spelled so strangely today.
Right.
Just even last night, I was dealing with a woman named Cicely, who spelled it C-I-C-I-L-Y, as opposed to Cecily, you know. So, and it's so easy for editors to say, oh, he must mean.
Right.
You know, and of course, they can check and say, do you mean, you know, but that takes time. So it's just as easy to throw in CQ.
Right.
So, I use it quite a bit.
Oh.
So,
yeah, it's, for those who work in media, especially in print, it's a term that's thrown around quite often, but I certainly I don't know.
Oh, yeah, but for the average theater goer, it just isn't a friendly title. So I'm very surprised that they settled on it, too. You're right, Michael. I agree with you.
All right. So we're on to our next topic, which is Galileo. Peter, you saw that, and why don't you tell us what you thought?
I've never much liked Galileo as a play because the scene I want to see is not in the play. And this is the story of Galileo, who has discovered that, ooh, wait a minute, does the Earth move around the sun? Everybody's been saying that the sun moves around the Earth, so could it be? And he comes up and with his telescope, and he's starting to prove things, and this is something the Catholic Church does not want to hear, and they are going to suppress him. And the scene where they actually bring him in, and we're told they're not going to torture him. What they're going to do is show him the instruments of torture and let him make a decision. I want to see that scene. And neither Bertolt Brecht, apparently, nor Charles Laughton, the translator, certainly let us see that scene. It's the type of play that you assume what's going to happen is that because this is a rugged individualist, this is a visionary, that he's going to triumph. And it's not a story of that at all. He gives in. He caves in. And it reminded me of Kurt Vonnegut's novel Cat's Cradle, which was a big novel when I was a kid. I don't know if people are still reading it, but that deals with a god named Bakonin who lives on an island. And Bakonin is wanted by the authorities because they don't want this religion to exist. And there's a big hook. That's the way they punish people. Think of a fishing hook, but enormous, and they just impale you on the hook, and that's how you are killed. And Bakunin writes, "If I am ever put to death on the hook, expect a very human performance." You know what I mean? I'm going to yell and scream and carry on. So Galileo expects a very human performance from him, too. He's afraid, and he doesn't have the courage, and who can blame him? Because, you know, you see these instruments of torture. So he's just, okay, I recant. Okay, that's it. You know, and he has to live the rest of his life under this cloud. And there are people who believed in him tremendously, including one character who's played very, very well by a young actor who I've seen a few times in New Jersey. And I think he's really terrific, Andy Phelan. And I really believe he has a career ahead of him. F. Murray Abraham plays Galileo and plays him quite well. But I want to see that scene. However, the play does serve a marvelous purpose because it does bring up the question. We see a situation now where we know the church was wrong. Now the question becomes, are there any other famous and powerful institutions that could be wrong about things that are going on today? I think that could be the case. So that's the value of Galileo. So in that sense, it's a play for our times. There's also a very nice scene where we see this guy in his underwear, and he's about to get dressed, and he's talking imperiously, and eventually he turns out he's the Pope, and there he is dressed as the Pope. But when we see him in his underwear, he's just another guy, you know, and that reminds us that, okay, you can be a Pope, but when all is said and done, you're a man, and nothing's going to come away from that that you're anything but a guy, you know, and face it. So a lot of good lines in the play. As much of the truth gets out as we push through, it's true, isn't it? A good evening, but not a great one. And you want so much more. But a valuable play in being food for thought for people in saying the church was wrong once. Could it be again?
It's great to see F. Murray Abraham in such a small, intimate venue.
Yes, CSC on 13th Street is a small space, three-quarter thrust. Oh, and by the way, I'll make a subjective judgment here. It's much more potent to see this play than it is to see the film version that was made in the 70s. This is subjective because Topol plays the part, and I find him excruciating in the picture. So now others may say, well, nah, come on, what are you talking about? Topol's a great actor. He was terrific in Galileo. Fine. You're entitled to your opinion. So am I. And, so it's a movie I just can't bear to watch. There was a part of me that wanted to come home and watch it, after I saw the play, just to see, if there were profound differences in the film version, but the idea of watching him do it again, was just too painful for me. So anyway, if you want to see Galileo, I would urge you to get to CSC rather than watch that film version, which is available on DVD.
It's playing a classic stage company, and it was extended through March 18th. So if you're interested, get down and see it. We'll have a link to it in the show notes. Michael got a chance to see Rutherford and Son at the Min Theater Company. Michael, you want to tell us about that?
Rutherford and Son is another stellar example of the Mint Theater taking a virtually forgotten play, certainly forgotten by the general public, and giving it an excellent production and making you sit there and think, oh my God, I can't believe that this is not done more often. And in this case, the play is especially significant because it was written by a woman named, I suppose it's pronounced Gita, G-I-T-H-A, last name Sowerby, British woman, and it premiered at the Royal Court Theatre in 1912 and apparently was an amazing success at a time when the idea of a woman playwright was extremely, extremely rare. I mean, there had been people before, certainly Aphra Behn, but especially for a woman of her class, you know, an upper class young British woman to write a play, it was quite the phenomenon. And I'm not sure exactly why it has fallen into semi obscurity, especially because the themes and the subject matter are so incredibly pertinent and modern. And in a nutshell, it's about this industrialist, John Rutherford, who owns a glassworks, and it's about he's a horrible, very imperious, cold, driven man, and we see his despicable treatment of his family members, his daughters, and his extended family, and in fact, during the course of the play, he winds up basically driving away everyone and is left alone at the end. People have compared it to Ibsen, and I could certainly see the comparison that, you know, The Master Builder leaps to mind, but several other plays also. It's about the pursuit of a career at the expense of one's personal relationships, and it's really very, very well written. I suppose one might say that some of the strokes are very broad, but it was 1912, and you know, when we think of the style of plays that were being written back then, but for the most part, it's shockingly modern, and I urge everyone to see it. It's a really excellent production. It's in three acts, but it's about 2.5 hours long. And at the end of the second act, one of the daughters, Janet, played by Sarah Surrey, has this searing monologue where she finally tells her father off, and decades of she's an unmarried woman in her. Well, into her 30s, I suppose, and all of her decades and years and years of unhappiness and every bit of resentment and hatred that she feels for her father come screaming out at him, and it's an amazing moment for an actress, and she really did a stupendous job with it, did Sarah Surrey. So, but that's only one moment in it. It's a great piece, and bravo for the umpteenth time to the Mint Theater Company.
Yeah, it's playing down at the Mint Theater Company through April 8th.
Yeah, that extended. Yeah,
that extended as well.
Before that. And also, this is a revival of a revival.
Right.
They did it years ago. And and they felt that it didn't get its due then because it was opening right around September 11th. And as a result, certainly we had other things on our mind during 9/11. And they wanted to give it another chance, which is really great. I don't know how much of the cast has come back. I know Robert Hogan has come back. He did it 10 years ago. He's playing Rutherford, I assume, Michael?
Yes, and we have Eli James as his son John, James Patrick Nelson as his son Richard, Sarah Surrey, as I said, as Janet, Sandra Shipley as Anne, Allison McLemore as Mary, David Van Pelt, I believe that he was in the first cast.
I see.
And as Martin, and Dale Soles as Mrs. Henderson.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Dale, who was an original cast member of The Magic Show.
Yep.
She's the girl who introduced a song that was a cabaret standard for a while, West End Avenue. Boy, it was in the late 70s, it was impossible to go to any cabaret show and not hear West End Avenue. Also sang The Lion Tamer in that show, a very nice Stephen Schwartz song. Mm. A show that is pretty much forgotten today, but it was one of the longest running shows in Broadway history at that time. So it's nice to see Dale still around after more than a third of a century. Good for her.
All right. We have a video that the Mint Theater Company provided. We'll put that on the show notes. So if you go to BroadwayRadio.com, you'd be able to see that video as well. Peter was out of town for part of the week. He was in Cincinnati watching a production of Into the Woods. Peter, why don't you tell us about that?
Well, the thing I want to mention about this, the gentleman who runs the program out there, Aubrey Berg, really is a masterful director. And he solved some Into the Woods problems that I have had with the show for the last quarter century. The first act of the show is supposed to be funny, and a lot of it is. The fairy tale characters run into each other, and frustrations occur when the baker and his wife have to get four ingredients to have a child, and they, little by little, they're getting one, they lose one, they get one, they lose one, that type of thing. You have altercations between Red Riding Hood and the wolf, and much of that is funny. The thing is that this show is set at midnight. And there's a lot of talk about this midnight, the next midnight. Comedy is best served when it's done brightly. Yeah, and I always felt that Into the Woods had a problem there by making everything so dark in the first act. So Aubrey Berg simply said it on a night when there's a full moon. And I think that's a very good idea, because this way we can see brightness. And it really helped the comedy along. I'm going to give just one other example of something he did that I thought was very smart. What happens, as happens in the original Grimm tales, though not, and most times you hear the Cinderella story, when the time comes for the prince to come around with the shoe, looking to see if there's anybody who fits the shoe precisely, well, the Cinderella's stepmother wants her stepdaughters to be very much in the running for this prize, so she cuts off part of the heel of her daughter, so that it can fit into the shoe. So in the original production, the prince rode off on a horse with the girl on the back of the horse. Fine, you know, nobody can quarrel with that. But what Aubrey Berg did, which was so funny, was to have the horse be a hobby horse, and as a result, they both had to clomp off running with the horse, the way you do when you have a hobby horse. You stick between your legs and you ride off. So as a result, the girl is clomping off, and you know, her part of her foot is missing now, and I mean, that hurts. So so as a result, you know, that's much more dramatic. All right, one more. For years, since we were children, we heard, "Grandma, what great eyes you have. Grandma, what teeth you have," you know, with Red Riding Hood and the wolf. And what was so good is he made the wolf much more three-dimensional by having the wolf getting tired and frustrated of these questions, you know, like, "Grandma, you, now what?" You know, I mean, that type of attitude. And that was very funny, too. So terrific production done on a unit set, which looked like a Shakespearean theater, not unlike the Globe. So Rapunzel's tower was simply a high window. And when Jack sang Giants in the Sky, he was on a balcony. But a lot of imagination. And once again, these kids out of Cincinnati, they're really, really good. And there's an excellent possibility you'll see them on Broadway next year, the year after. Or you'll see them working, because so many of them succeed very well. Ashley Brown, who was Mary Poppins. I don't mean in Mary Poppins. I mean was Mary Poppins, went there. And she's just one of many. It's a rare Broadway musical that doesn't have at least one Cincinnati kid in it. Newsies about to open as three. So they're adding up. I thought it was one of the finest Into the Woods I've seen, the 14 productions I've seen. But boy, does that lighting help that comedy, I'll tell you. It really does.
Peter, to clarify, you don't mean that the entire action of the entire show is intended to take place at midnight, do you?
No, but there's so much talk about One Midnight Gone.
Yeah, in Act 2, I think, yeah, primarily.
No, in the first act. There's a lot of talk about midnight in the first act. And so it's always been played terribly darkly, it seems to me.
I see what you're saying, yeah. No.
And we hear from Mr. Riedel that this is not going to be, we don't have to go to Cincinnati to see Into the Woods, do we?
No, it's going to be in the park this summer. Yeah. And that's a production that was in the park in London last year. And if you look at the Sondheim Finishing the Hat book, or Look I Made a Hat, I guess it is, there's a very nice two-page spread of what the set looked like. And it looked very exciting. So, it'll be fun to see it out in the park. It's a very good show for the park, isn't it? I mean, given that so much of it takes place outdoors to begin with. So, I think that'll be really good.
And there's also rumors and talk of After the Park having a life in some other venue, possibly on Broadway again. Isn't that pretty short in between Into the Wood revivals? Or
I know, isn't it something? But time does pass, and it may be more years than we think. It seemed like the day before yesterday that it was at the Broadhurst in that revival. But needless to say, a lot of people didn't see it, you know. So, and it is one of Sondheim's most popular shows.
Well, since James Lapine, you know, keeps rewriting everything, both his own work and everyone else's, maybe he can take another shot at the second act, which I think it's generally fair to say that there's a general consensus that it just does not work as well as the first act, which is a total delight as far as I'm concerned.
When I first heard that this show was happening, and I first learned of it in the Craig Zaden Sondheim and Company second edition, and when he was talking about, you know, that all these fairy tale characters would meet each other, and that they would, and the baker and his wife would be looking for things that these characters had, a cape that's red, you know, and I thought, this is going to be a blast. This is going to be hilarious. This is going to be the funniest thing Sondheim has done since Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. So, and I remember I had a friend from Boston in town who went to the first preview, and he came back here and he was shell-shocked. I can still see the expression on his face as he was sitting here. And I said, well, what exactly is the problem? He said, you know, maybe Jerry Herman should have written this show. And, you know, I guess, you know, because of the fairy tale characters, you do expect that it's going to be funny. And yes, one cannot deny that those Grimm's fairy tales can get grim. But, you know, I really do believe that Into the Woods has become successful in spite of that second act and not because of that second act.
Yes, I would 100% agree, although many people would strongly disagree.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
I know. But to me, I really expected the show to be a laugh, L-A-F-F riot. And it's interesting, too, that Music Theater International, which licenses it, they have an Into the Woods Junior version, and they have plenty of junior versions for their shows where they cut down the shows and let kids do them from beginning to end. But for Into the Woods, it's the first act that they offer is their junior. They don't get into when it gets really,
how
really
interesting,
isn't it? Yeah. Oh. That they just leave it. And of course it was very famous during previews that, people were walking out, not because they didn't like what was going on. They assumed the show was over at the end of the first act because everybody's singing about Happily Ever After and all that. So, so in fact, they had the narrator add the line, to be continued, you know, so people would know, don't go home, you know. But, you know, maybe a lot of people would have been just as happy just seeing the first act. Because really, people die in the second act. You don't expect to die. I don't know about you, Michael, or James, but there are at least two characters. I'm very surprised, you know, bite the dust in Into the Woods, and yes. I don't expect that to happen. So, oh well.
James, weren't you in Into the Woods at some point?
Yeah, I did, Jack. But my favorite thing is just the boom squish. I hope they don't change that.
Boom crunch?
Yeah.
There's a squish, too. There's a squish.
Boom squish
pitch at this
moment. Yeah. No, it's a really fun show. It's got so many layers to it. I think it's like the Bugs Bunny type of thing where it could be entertaining for both children and adults at the same time. And I'm looking forward to it. But as Peter said, it feels like it was just yesterday. But I guess it was a number of years ago that it was revived.
So, yeah. Yeah.
We'll see. You know, I can't complain about a Sondheim Renaissance. I can't.
No, neither can I. And, you know, it only ran around 200-odd performances in that revival. The first one ran over 700. Still, when you add them up, I mean, how many people come through New York and all that, there probably is a market for it. So I bet they get, if it moves to Broadway, they'll get at least 200 performances out of it again, perhaps more.
Hopefully so. They'll market it better than the last show. I felt that the Dodgers produced the last one, right?
Mm. That sounds right to me.
I don't think they, whoever produced it, I think it was the Dodgers. I don't think it was marketed very, very well.
They also had problems like Laura Benanti injuring herself and having to miss a lot. And
I think that, you know, Laura Benanti missing a bunch of performances, she had a neck injury that was pretty bad. Mm. And still plagues her to this day. But the, you know, I think a lot of people talked about Laura missing performances, and that's very inside baseball, but I don't think Laura Benanti at that point, or even now, sells a lot of tickets.
Sure.
She's very, very talented, but she's not a huge star.
Well, right, but, you know, but sometimes the human factor of producing sometimes involves sometimes you close the show because you just can't deal with the problems involved. I know producers who have done. I'm not going to give names, but I know a circumstance where a producer said, there's just so much, nobody's getting along and all that. We're not going to make our money back anyway. Let's just close it now. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, let me bring up Curtains, which ran over 500 performances and didn't get very good reviews and didn't do very well at the Tony Awards. Yes, David Hyde Pierce won. But I remember Roger Berlin telling me, you know, it's so wonderful that everybody in this cast just loves each other. They get along so well. And I've often thought, if they didn't, I wonder if he would have pulled the plug a lot sooner. Because it was clear from the outset that they weren't going to make back their money. But why not keep it going if you're just making expenses, even though you're not making much money? Why not keep it going if everybody's getting along and you're not getting a call every day saying, you know what he did last night? You know, I mean, so sometimes there can be situations like that too.
Absolutely, Peter. I would never mention the revival of Showboat in public.
Okay. Fine. Duly noted.
Wow. Stories that came out of that one. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's say that Stritch didn't make a bunch of, she didn't make a bunch of Christmas card lists that year. Alrighty, I want to interrupt us here to ask for some help from our listeners. I appreciate everybody listening and contacting us every week and letting us know their feedback, and we ask you to continue to do that. I want to ask you to do us a favor. We are hooking up finally with an advertising firm that promotes podcasts, and one of the things that they need us to do is have our listeners fill out a podcast survey. And so I'm going to mention it over the next couple of weeks, ask you to go to broadwayradio.com, and at the top of the page there's going to be a link where everybody, you can click there and take a survey. And it really is a demographic survey and asks you what type of listener you are and what other podcasts you listen to, so they can understand what kind of advertisers to approach to support our show. So I would like you to do that if you can go to broadwayradio.com. Also at broadwayradio.com is the show notes, so you can get in touch with Peter, Michael, and myself, see the videos that we post, or see the links to the shows and articles that we talk about each week. Also has an archive of all of our shows there, so if you want to go back and take a look at things, you can do that as well. And it has our contact information, so you can contact Peter, Michael, and myself there as well. If you want to subscribe to our podcast, you can also do that there by clicking on the iTunes subscribe button. That way you won't miss any episodes of Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. And if you'd like to listen to us outside of iTunes, you can listen to us on the Stitcher app, which is available for the iPhone and the iPod and the Android devices and the BlackBerry and most other smartphones is available on Stitcher. So you can stream that and listen to it there. You can also listen to us on Broadway World Radio, Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. If you'd like to listen to us from your computer or at work or various other places, that's a great way to do it. We're going to talk a little bit about Two Passings, which had two gentlemen that had a great impact upon the Broadway community. We're going to start off with Ted Mann from Circle in the Square. Peter, why don't you talk about Ted?
This was really a producer. When he was just starting out, he would simply open the phone book and start cold calling strangers for money. And that's amazing to me. And yet he was able to get shows on. He also took a word, not quite out of context, but used it in his ads. One of his first productions, Hot Atkinson Times, you know, that's all he did, because Off-Broadway ads, and he was a big founder of Off-Broadway, were just little tiny ads. There was only enough room to say Hot Atkinson Times, but nevertheless, that brought people in. And but what he's most noted for is his revival of Eugene O'Neill's The Iceman Comet. Now, this was a play that was very long, and it had previously bombed on Broadway. And he stayed with it, even though during rehearsals it didn't look good. Howard Da Silva actually bailed out of it. He was going to do the part of Hickey, and he left to do a movie. And yet, he kept going, and he was determined to get this show on. And to paraphrase a line from Curtin's, people cameth to the Iceman cometh. And that started him off. And what was so great was that Carlotta O'Neill, the widow, who had Long Day's Journey in Tonight sitting in her house, it was supposed to be that they weren't going to let it happen for 25 years after Eugene O'Neill had died. She was so impressed with Ted Mann's production of The Iceman Cometh that she gave him the rights to Long Day's Journey into Night, and it got done in the 50s, long before it was supposed to get done. And the thing is, she could have got a lot of money from bigger producers. She could have, but she was so impressed with him that she made it happen. And the irony was that she gave him the rights. I remember this, that she gave to him in August of 1956. She said, okay, you can do it. But they opened it in November. I mean, imagine, you know, that's pretty good. It cost $95,000. He got the money.
Wow.
He made it happen. And all this came out in a book that he wrote some years ago that I thought was fascinating. One of the best theater books I'd read in a long time, called Journeys in the Night. And the story of how he got started, how he continued, how Circle in the Square downtown, which doesn't exist as a theater anymore, but there is Circle in the Square uptown. And he was still working. Just a couple of years ago, I know, he invited me to a production of And the World Goes Round that his students were doing. So he was still out there, you know. So a great man of the theater, and really an important building block of the Off-Broadway movement. I dare say the Off-Broadway phenomenon that happened in the 50s and the 60s, the commercial Off-Broadway theater that existed then, would have had a harder time, or may not have existed as we knew it, had it not been for Ted Mann.
Yeah, he was, aside from his producing endeavors, his Circle and Square Theater School, and all the other inspiration that he gave and the impact upon the Broadway community is going to be felt for a long time to come. You know, we hope that we continue to have people that are that dedicate their lives to the theater arts the way that he did. We've linked to in the show notes a really interesting obituary from the New York Times about it that goes deeper into it. Also, we lost Howard Kissel, the Daily News theater critic. Michael, you want to talk about Howard first?
Sure. I didn't know him all that well, but I did know him. He was I would say he had a very gentle demeanor, which is somewhat unusual in this field. And a very, very smart, very intellectual person, but not in a forbidding way. Just you really always felt respectful, at least I did when I was in his presence. And he is, aside from his decades of writings, reviews for Women's Wear Daily and the Daily News and several other outlets, he will probably be best known for his biography of David Merrick called The Abominable Showman, which is an unauthorized biography, I should mention, which I believe came out while Merrick was still alive. Isn't that right, Peter?
If not, damn close to it, certainly.
Yeah. And he also wrote an update of Lehman Engel's 1971 piece, Words with Music, and something he wrote quite recently, which I suppose didn't get that much attention, is a book called New York Theater Walks, it's a wonderful book. You buy it, and it's self-guided tours of the theater district and also other places in the city that have some kind of a theater connection. It's really fascinating, and some of us may think we know a lot of that stuff, but you'd be amazed how much you don't necessarily know, and just the fascinating little tidbits. So I think that would be a great tribute to him. If you don't have that book, get your hands on it and do some of those self-guided tours sometime, because they're really, really fascinating.
What a lovely suggestion, Michael. Very good.
That's nice.
That's nice. I saw Howard Lust at Merrily We Roll Along on February 8th. I had no idea. I mean, I know he hadn't been well. I remember at Joe Stein's memorial, he was using a walker, but the fact that he wasn't using it afterwards, when I saw him at subsequent times, made me think that, okay, he was on the mend. It was a liver transplant that he had had. Am I correct about that? A gentleman who came from Milwaukee who went to the Roadhouse there and fell in love with theater as a result of seeing even the Lunts, I remember he told me once, seeing them there. So a real old world theater man. And certainly he was frustrated with some of the things that had happened in recent decades with the theater. And he was a little depressed that things were not going to be as they were. But nevertheless, he still went. He still paid attention. He was still there to say when something was really, really good. I missed him immeasurably already. We appeared on many panels together as well. And I remember somebody asking us once what we would like to go back to see. And he said the original production of Hamlet, and virtually everybody else on the panel suddenly was agreeing with him. And I thought, wow, that was very interesting that they followed his lead, that they didn't even want to give it any more thought, that Howard had said that and they were following his lead. And I remember telling the story to a friend who said, and then you said Rockabye Hamlet, didn't you? Because it was a musical. And I said, no, I saw Rockabye Hamlet, so I didn't have to say that. But here's to you, Howard Kissel. Here's to you, Ted Mann. Thanks for making Broadway better than it was.
There's a marvelous anecdote about Howard that Robert Simonson retells in his Playbill obit of him. Apparently, Patti LuPone, Howard had published a very positive review of LuPone's performance in Masterclass, and it says the actress, encountering the critic in Times Square, kissed him on the lips. Ooh. Like a good reporter, Mr. Kissel wrote up the event in the news. Quote, "I feel no compunctions about declaring that kissing critics should be encouraged. We live in times when all power relationships are being revised. Only by throwing off traditional restraints can we find healthier, more meaningful roles to play. We hear all this blather about encouraging, quote, dialogue, unquote, between adversaries. In this area, there has been all too much talk. It's time for something more imaginative. Patti LuPone has set an important precedent."
I remember hearing lots of Broadway producers saying that Ben Brantley should kiss. Well, anyway.
Oh, yes, all right. Then,
Frank Rich, not Ben Brantley, excuse me.
I don't think we're going to top that live, James. Yeah. Place to end.
All righty. So I want to thank everybody for listening. On behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying have a good week, and thank you for listening to Broadway Videos This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.
No more giants waging war. Can't we just pursue our lives with our children and our wives till that happier day arrives? How do you ignore all the witches, all the curses, all the wolves, all the lies, the false hopes, the goodbyes, the reverses, all the wondering what even worse is still in store, all the children, all the giants.